You are listening to the Spacecraft Podcast, conversations on how innovative design can transform the workplace environment. This podcast is brought to you by them, with host Dan Mosscrop.
Welcome to Spacecraft, and today we've got Ivana Stancic, who's an associate at Tate Hindle. Ivana, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, a pleasure. We met some time ago, long before COVID. It was during a Place Labs talk, and you were talking about how, as much as we like to design things as beautiful structures and things, it's more about the agility and how people can adapt spaces to live in them properly.
Yes, it was a great event that we met at, and I still love the work that Place Labs did and did do. Hopefully soon some more, we'll see some more. And yes, I think this has been a topic that interested me for a long time before COVID. How do we inhabit spaces? How do we use them? And how do we make them more flexible than they are? And one of the things that when I first moved here from Serbia, I loved the fact that there were these much loved homes from Victorian and Georgian era that lasted.
Much sought after, aren't they?
Sought after. And, you know, starting in doing housing design and architecture and here thinking, why aren't we learning the lessons? You know, why are these homes so popular and why are so much loved? And the homes that we're designing today aren't coming close, you know, after all the things that we've achieved.
They just lack that versatility, don't they?
Yes.
Anywhere I've lived in that's modern, one of which was Red Square in Stoke Newington, it just felt like everything was ready to fall apart at any time. And you were really kind of heavily instructed on how you had to use the space in every bit of the area.
Exactly. And that's sort of what prompted me first to look at the way we use, you know, why aren't we designing in this flexibility and agility? And then obviously with COVID, now that's become quite a hot topic. So it's very current and still working on developing that in my residential design. So
yeah, I think this is why we wanted to get you on today, because I think there's such an interesting blurred line now. I mean, I love the way you think anyway, but you've come originally from JTP, where you were mainly on master planning for big resi projects.
Yes, I've spent sort of 9 years, I think, at JTP. So when I first came to UK, I worked in a small practice doing mainly resi. And I loved that when I graduated from architecture, that's all I wanted to do, housing, I thought. When I worked in housing for 3-4 years, I realized actually it's a lot more about spaces around buildings as well as homes and, you know, what do buildings mean in the bigger picture. And so I then moved to doing master planning as well as residential and mixed use designs, which I loved for 9 years. And I've learned a lot and did a lot and moved to Tate Hindle now, which I'm really enjoying.
So Tate Hindle have got a really interesting mixture, haven't they? They've got, you know, a lot of commercial work. They've got a lot of resi work. So is that what sort of drew you to them? They obviously do some really lovely work as well. Some nice stuff going on there.
Yes, no, definitely. I think what one of the things that drew me to them as well is that they have this unique vantage point on doing commercial and resi as the sort of main things. But they also do master planning, which I'm hoping to work quite a lot on as well. And it gives you this unique vantage point. And they do quite a lot of detailed design. So they cross a lot of scales. And I've always enjoyed that aspect, working on the big picture stuff. And the lessons learned you apply to working on detailed design, and vice versa, you look at design of rooms and spaces and individual homes, and you apply the lessons learned to the master planning and sort of strategic thinking. And I love jumping across scales, and Tate Hindle is great at that. They have some beautiful designs and award-winning architecture, and as well doing master planning, so a great, and then doing commercial work, which again now is really important for master planning. So yes, it's been a great fit.
So that's a little bit of a summary. And I love your bio, by the way. There's loads of things I didn't know about you here, even though I thought I knew you. Shortlisted for the World Architecture News Female Frontier Awards, and then Reba Rising Stars in 2020.
I think it was shortlisted. It wasn't chosen, but yes, it was accolades.
Nice. I wasn't on it.
No. I think quite a lot of it came on the back of the international work, because through the last sort of 9-10 years, I've been working quite a lot of in the UK, but also internationally. We have a really interesting project in Czech Republic in Prague that's been going on for years, and it's now on site in some new phases, and as well as some work in Russia.
Such a shame about that, because I know you were really excited. It was such a nice project, wasn't it?
It's a real shame that what's happening on so many levels. So, but I've always enjoyed working there, and I, hopefully for everyone's sake, the situation will become better.
Yeah. Jumping back to Place Labs.
Yes.
You did a really lovely talk, and this was about, I think what I loved about it, it was the spaces that I wasn't expecting to love, or the ones that quite a lot of the images that you were showing that were really effective spaces were often quite muddled. You know, as designers, we have like beautiful straight lines, and, you know, there's the lines across the corners of the lawn that we're all familiar with. But what you started to discover, the successful spaces were things that people had a lot of...
Agency,
that's the word I'm looking for. Yeah, to adapt them.
Yes, I think that's one of my biggest passions in architecture, is allowing people agency. I argue so many times with my colleagues that design unopenable windows into places. But what is the point of a window that you cannot open, especially for homes? Yes, it's beautiful. And this is such an architect's thing, to design a beautiful, you know, minimum frame. But you come into a room and there's this little slither of a window that you can open. You can't even poke your head through it. And, you know, so one of my biggest passion is giving people agency, and just looking at the other end, looking at the user perspective. Life is messy, and we all, when we inhabit spaces, we create a mess, and that mess.
Speak for yourself. I mean, yeah, my desk chair is like a bomb site upstairs. It drives everyone mad.
But that's life, you know, and I think we should celebrate that. And through flexibility, through my sort of flexibility, isn't for the sake of flexibility. It's for the sake of giving people agency over places they inhabit and they live in, which empowers them and makes them feel good about themselves, because they can shape their environment. And I think that's really important for us that are designing people's homes, to think about how will people be able to adapt this to their own, because we all have unique situations in life. And if we can't adapt our homes to suit those situations, we don't feel welcome.
Well, I think the great example is, as you talked about with the Victorian and Georgian homes compared to modern, we were suddenly thrown this big curveball where everyone had to try and find a way of working from home, creating an office space with sometimes a very unadaptable environment.
Yes, it's a great sort of demonstration of how some of the unflexible designs are failing us. I don't want to be unjust to the designers. We're all learning all the time, but the fact that, you know, Victorian and Georgian houses, quite often you'll have the front, you'll have four rooms which are sort of equally sized, and you don't always have to specify what's a bedroom, what's a living room, what's a dining room. You could use any for all those purposes. And then what's also quite unusual for today's time, to have two windows on each. So any of those rooms, you can potentially split into two smaller rooms. You can have a small office space, you can have a partition. And it's these... spatially, they are slightly larger, and it's space. The size is important, but it's also thinking about these small details that are allowing us to create flexible spaces that accommodate working from home. Because we can't all afford an office, an additional office, but we can afford to have a well thought through space that we can have a corner or a smaller office that's made out of, you know, flexible space. So, I think it's just really important. Thinking about it going forward, but rather than thinking, yes, we need an additional room for every house, it's actually, can we make it more efficient and more thought through the way we design the spaces we are designing?
We fed into one of your projects in Walthamstow when you're at JTP, so early in the concept stage, really, just to flag that, you know, we weren't heavily involved in it. It was really just a few ideas. But what I really liked about that, even then, it was a few years ago, you know, you had the co-working spaces downstairs, and it was really thinking about the functionality of the whole residential scheme as a whole and everything, how it adapts. So obviously there's a lot of learnings from what you're doing. What were your main takeaways from big projects you worked on in JTP?
I'd say main takeaways is that there is no one size fit all. We've always been taught, and I've always designed to suit the character of the place and to suit the local areas, and, you know, what do people want and how do they live and how would they like to live. I think that's one of the key. But post-COVID and sort of with the lessons learned, I think one of the main takeaways is this blurred lines between office and workplace. And that's, I think, why Tate Hindle has such a unique vantage point. And it's great to hear my colleagues on the office side to learn, because all of a sudden our homes are now functioning a bit like more like office spaces, and vice versa, offices are functioning like homes, and they need to provide that comfort and to
that
be attractive,
softness. Yeah.
So I think the blurring of the lines, and it's, you know, we go back to Jane Jacobs talking about it how many years ago. It's, we can't be so strictly zoning things anymore. We need to allow for things to change, and we need to allow for people to work and live in the same space. Mm. In the next 20 years, we might be all looking at something completely different. Mm. The blurring of lines is the biggest, one of the biggest lessons, and what I enjoy quite a lot. Again, as I said, life is quite messy, and we need to allow, in designs, we need to allow for that freedom of change to happen within our designs.
Well, talking about messiness, obviously you're right in the thick of it at the minute. You've got the lovely Luca, who's appeared in your lives a couple of years ago now. Is it three, is it?
He's two now.
Two.
Yes, so life has become messy for the better, definitely. Yeah. He's, yes, we've had a little boy, and it's been absolutely brilliant. And again, the mess is good. So
it just teaches so much, though, because, like, I don't think I ever understood what parents go through, you know.
No.
Like, so especially in the current climate where you're trying to work from home, you're trying to occupy a two-year-old, you know. I remember when I was much younger than I am now, you know, in my 20s, and people had kids at work, and I'd be like, why can they get to leave early? You know, it just felt really unfair. But knowing what they actually deliver and go through, you know, it's a huge learning curve for me, and really respecting what people actually need in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it was always this, you know, we talk about blurred lines. There was always this, like, really sharp, you go to work, you finish work, you go home. And it felt really easy for me. I'm currently home alone because my wife's in Canada at the minute, and just learning all the stuff that she does through the day that I was not aware of. But trying to create a space that can satisfy all those requirements is quite difficult, right?
It really is. And I think, as we keep talking about it, COVID has really helped the parents. And luckily, I've become a parent post-COVID, so there's a lot more understanding for parents and for what they go through. It's been absolutely brilliant having the ability to work from home, although I don't need it at the moment. I'm lucky enough to be able to walk to work. Having that flexibility, which is unthinkable, you know, if you think about 5 years ago, having the flexibility we have now. But again, it's about the empowerment that people have gotten through this flexibility to cater their days, to suit their lives, and to work a bit from home and in the evening to make up for the things they haven't managed to do while doing the school run. All of that was not nearly that easy 5 years ago. So I think we've come a long way. I'm lucky enough to be making the most of it. I think I now understand what families had to sacrifice before. And in this society, you know, all societies, mothers especially, I think the flexibility of the life we have now has given a lot to working parents and working mothers, and sort of brought the situation a bit more even. Not to share, you know, we did shared parental leave as well, which is absolutely wonderful. When I talk to, you know, so many people don't have this privilege. It's quite rare. I don't think many countries in the world do this. So I think the world is moving forward.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I quite often talk about being frustrated that we haven't taken full advantage of what happened. You know, we shifted so far in a different direction during COVID, and I feel like we've sort of come a little way back too much to what we used to be, and certainly some businesses have. But what I do... what I probably don't acknowledge is how much that sort of mental shift has changed, and how the expectations changed. And, you know, I think you said a while ago, the genie's out of the bottle. You know, there's definitely such a massive shift in what people expect now, and the fairness and how we treat people and the benefits they can get, even little things like not commuting, giving you 2 hours back in a day.
It's incredible. So what I'm working on at the moment is trying to do this visual representation of sort of what has happened. There's been a report by Summix recently to put some numbers against the assumptions. We all keep talking, oh, people are working from how many people? Well, actually, they came up to a number of 5.3 million additional people post-COVID are working from home. And that's only going to rise. So we're doing at the moment this bit piece of sort of visual research into how the world was quite divided before. You had your home life, you had your work life, and you had a commute in between. And now we've got this Venn diagram of commute reducing. So when you think about even on average, if you commuted 10 hours a day, and if you now reduce that to 5 hours a week on average, and you put those 5 hours back into your home zone or your community, you've got 5 hours more in your life to start with. You're more relaxed and you have more time on your hands. You're not as tired, but also it's this amazing opportunity. So what do you do? You know, what do you do with this time? And you can actually use it for your, you know, for the benefit of your community life. You can exercise as numerous things, but we're trying to visually do a bit of a representation of this, of, you know, the amount of, because I don't think people realize how much time they've gained, because it all happened sort of gradually. There was this big shock. We were all in a lockdown, and then we came out, and actually our lives are a bit looser now, but that's good. And so we're doing this. What we're also trying to picture then, what happens if you completely take out the commute out of the picture, and this is where master planning comes in. I think this is where I'm really interested in how the master planning story can help the communities. We assume that we have to commute, but this has not been forever. This is only a 20th century invention. You know, we build roads, we build railways, and we moved out and out and out. And all of a sudden people are commuting an hour and a half to work. But this is where master planning comes in. Can we actually bring the work closer to home and cut out the commute completely? And it's, you know, much disputed 15-minute communities are not about prioritizing pedestrians and cyclists only. That's just a tiny little piece. It's thinking about, actually, can we live in and work in the same place and use our time a lot more better than in a very stressful, costly and unsustainable commute? So anyway, it's really interesting being at this point where I can see where the office design is going, and it's absolutely amazing. I think that won't change, nor will the flexibility of homes change with 15-minute communities. It will only reinforce this fact of designing offices as hubs and allowing them to be more sociable, having spaces for quiet working, for focus. They're so different, offices these days, to where we had them pre-COVID, aren't they? So I think that will all stay. So that's what we're doing at Tate Hinder, looking at all these three perspectives and trying to come up with what's coming next.
It is interesting, isn't it? We talked about the sort of space and time to think that not having the commute has changed, in that, you know, from a master planning perspective, it's really interesting how we're creating this richer ecosystem at home. You know, when everyone stopped going into work, there was this big scream up about what about the shops and the service providers around us. And, you know, quite a lot of them tend to be big chains, you know, especially in central London. Whereas when you're working from home, I think one of the examples I used is when I'm working from home, it gives me the opportunity to actually go to the butchers rather than go to the Sainsbury's that I happen to walk past. So we're creating a much richer ecosystem and supporting more independent users around us, right?
Definitely. And what we're doing is we are stepping away from, you know, dormitories that we've had in the suburbs, and we're actually building the shops and the cafes that are closing in central London are not disappearing. They're just relocating in a different form to our communities where we live. So it's not like we'll go out less or we'll use them less. Yes, those specific ones, and it's really sad to see businesses close, but actually an opportunity opens for someone else, and if those same businesses could potentially locate somewhere where the rent is cheaper to start with, you know, if they go to zone 2 or 3 from zone 1 and open a nice deli at a cheaper rent. So I don't think that's necessarily, you know, they're not disappearing, they are just shifting, and I think that's for the better, because we are creating this really rich ecosystem where we live, and then some people might afford to live in central locations because of these things. So we're just mixing uses more, which is a great thing for life and for messy life.
What design changes are you seeing, so in the residential sector, how are we starting to accommodate the requirement for offices within buildings.
So I've seen there's a couple of recent projects by Tate Hindle and by other practices, they've, in terms of homes, where we're looking at not open plan living, but flexible plan living. And actually some of the homes being designed with partitions rather than walls. So even though we, in the current climate, we cannot increase, there has been some increase in footprints as well to accommodate working from home, but also looking at flexibility of those spaces. But I think we could learn much from Europe.
Yeah, you mentioned to me when we first started talking that they literally effectively sell you an empty box rather than a prescribed space.
Yes, most of the continent, and I was quite surprised when I came here to see that when you buy a new build flat or a house, you get a kitchen and a bathroom installed in it. And I was like, well, how do they know what kitchen do I want and how big a kitchen do I want?
You want the cheapest kitchen the developer could buy.
Yes, exactly. I have it back at home in Serbia, but also I think that's most of the France and Germany, it works the same way. When you buy a new built place, you buy it, you get the plumbing sorted, installed, but none of the fixtures. So you get to choose how big and how expensive the kitchen. So I have some friends that bought a new built flat and they said, well, neither of us cooks and we absolutely hate cooking. So we want more space in the living room. So we'll buy a tiny kitchenette, we'll have a kitchen, but we won't spend space or money on it. Whereas some other friends bought similar type flats and installed a big island in the kitchen, and, you know, all singing, all dancing kitchen. And I think that allows people to, learning from some lessons on the continent, will allow people to sort of live slightly differently. I think it's really important that we look at how, you know, we keep looking at these pictures of Amsterdam and Copenhagen cyclists and how leisurely they're cycling versus London's angry cyclists.
Much wear lycra, fluorescent.
Exactly. But that's not just because their culture is so much more relaxed, because those cyclists are actually covering a lot less miles they are in their daily cycle, because they're on the continent, they're used to living at different densities. Most of my friends have been raised in apartments rather than houses. Mm. It's the, you know, British thing of having a house in a garden. I must own my property. I must live
in
and my lawn. Whereas we talked about this from a personal example as well. We've decided to stick around in a more central location, but in less space. And in on the continent, especially in Scandinavian countries, they do it really well. They build really large apartments where you can actually raise a family and have big balconies, big floor to ceiling heights, really spacious, you know, room for everyone, room for entertaining and having friends over. But what that means is that their commute is actually so relaxed on a bicycle with a, you know, old bike that's not been geared up for, you know, high speeds and bombing down the cycling superhighway. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And I know some of our clients are sort of trying to pick up some of those lessons, but there is a bit of a culture change that has to happen, because we have to somehow compromise. We can't have it all. You can't have a large house with a large garden and live in a central location and have no commute. So I think something's got to give.
Similarly, you know, we all fell in love with the sort of New York warehouse concept, and we all sort of pushed even our Georgian and Victorian houses to stretch to be in these open plan environments.
Yeah,
and obviously that's, you now need thresholds and different environments to work in. So obviously that's tailoring into what you guys are doing.
Definitely, because I think the trend is the same on housing, on residential design and office. Open plan offices and open plan homes need a bit of adjustment. So we're looking at the moment, not open plan homes, we're looking at flexible plan homes. And similar with offices, we're not looking at open plan offices. We are still, but to an extent they need to be flexible. And we're accommodating a lot more different things within that open plan. It's not a sea of desks anymore. We're looking at sort of hubs for meeting rooms, Zoom calls. We're looking at socializing. We're looking at offices that have to be attractive and bring people in. We're looking at character. I think that's one important thing that came out. People somehow have stopped and thought about, actually, the places we inhabit are really important for our health and well-being. Mm-hmm. And we need to feel good in them. It makes us feel good in return. So thinking about, you know, having, I think retrofit is really important, and we do that quite a lot at Tate Hindle. It's one of our sort of key strengths. And it's been beautiful to look at all these buildings that have been so loved and have so much character and have their second or third life in them. Yeah. So I think a character is really important as well when we talk about the future of places and how we bring that in the old and the new buildings as well.
I think that's quite an interesting point, especially from what we do in design. We've talked privately on other things about, you know, how you know, the expectations of people getting people back to work within the office space. And I think this is a really interesting challenge. It's going to get harder because as home becomes better mm-hmm. at adapting to your requirements as an office, why do you need to go into the office? And we know it's all for social stuff and things like that, but if it's not meeting your needs, so you can't hide somewhere to do a Zoom call or Teams call or whatever, everything's going to have to level up, right? You can't just expect people to come back to the same spaces. We know this, but, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to get that right and get the balance perfect because you need to create the spaces that are going to attract people back to work, right? You've got to change what we're offering them to make them want to come back.
Definitely. And I think we've all seen this. You've seen it in your work and we've seen it at Tate Hindle, that the amount of things that, you know, rightfully so, biophilic design, and, you know, the office has to become a social hub. You need to want to see your colleagues and your friends at work. Outdoor spaces become really important. People now want to have some outdoor space in the offices, not just at home. So when Tate Hindle moved into the new office, it was really important. We've got this amazing terrace that we can have a break on and, you know, have drinks after work. And it's just, I think it's incredible to see how hard the office has to work to attract people back in. We now have, you know, Monday breakfast together and all these things that, they are, you know, they are enriching, as I said, ecosystem of both home and office has really become a lot richer and people have to try harder on both accounts. I think for me, the bottom line is the harder the commute is, the harder you'll get people back into the office.
Yeah.
So if you have a really grueling, long, expensive commute, you'll only come in the days that you really have to and you're made to come. Doesn't matter how attractive the office is. It still has to be attractive. But I think it's this thing of thinking, how do we actually address, you know, we're moving social lives, we're moving delis and cafes back into the community, but can we move offices into the communities as well? So that those people, that's coming from a personal perspective, I can work 50% of the time from home and I really appreciate the flexibility and I do sometimes, but because I'm so close to my office, I do like to come in as well and I have this choice. And I think that's the piece of work that we're working on at the moment. How does the master planning, you know, seem to be trying to always fix the effect and not the cause. We're trying to make the offices so much more attractive to bring people in, but actually what if people wanted to come in because it was easy to come in, if we had these magical 15-minute communities that, I don't want to, you know, talk about the culture wars that are happening at the moment, because I think that they will go away. But, you know, what's good about these not new, but sort of going back to these old strategies of actually having a mix of uses in one place.
It does feel like managed anger at the minute towards the 15-minute city. I can't see anything unattractive about it.
No. So
either they're not understanding it or it's just like manufactured purely based on car use.
I think, to be honest, there's a lot of car industry fuels, no pun intended, into these debates. They don't want us to be talking about, and they have a lot of money to fund some of this anger as well. So I think we should understand where people are coming. We should listen and understand where people are coming from. They are worried about their livelihoods and their businesses losing on. And we should, I think one of the solutions, again, this flex, meanwhile uses are absolutely brilliant to show people how good 15-minute communities can be. So instead of, I think I live in Tower Hamlets and we're in the middle of the culture wars where the council is trying to rip out all the great stuff that's been done by low traffic neighbourhoods. But what really has happened, I think, is, or as a, you know, master planner designer, I keep thinking, what could the council have done better? So we didn't end up in the situation we ended up in.
Is that based around like the complaints about fire trucks not being able to get through and things like that, right?
But it's mostly people not, you know, having to, people not being able to come as easily and conveniently to their home and park in front of them, they have to do a bit of a, you know, longer. So I think because we haven't, I've heard this recently and it's a really good strategy. Instead of saying, you know, you are bad because you're driving and I'm good because I'm cycling and, you know, you're pushing this world into, show people how good 15 communities and sustainable places are, how good a, you know, happy place they are. Show them how they could live better. Not, you know, don't tell them off for doing things wrong.
Yeah.
And I think this is where the meanwhile use comes in, because if you install trials, say play streets and school streets, if you didn't permanently fix them, if you said, we're trialing this for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, let's see how we go. You don't force the community to accept it before you've actually showed them how good it can be and how much benefit. Because what happened, for example, at Tower Hamlets, they've installed the low traffic neighborhoods. Some of us were thrilled by them. Quite a lot of community weren't. They voted in a council on the back of a promise that they will remove the low traffic neighborhoods. In the meantime, while this was all happening, people have changed their minds because they've realized, actually, once I've learned the route to get out of my neighborhood, this is so much better for my kids. There's so many more kids playing on the street. You know, it's just been brilliant. But
it was never sold in properly.
And people, and now quite a lot of people have changed their minds about it. And I saw it in, there were same houses in my neighborhood. It's had the paper saying,
in the window,
15-minute prisons or whatever.
It's removed.
A year later, they had the paper, you know, the board saying, keep our streets, save streets. But it was, you know, it was too late. The council was already voted in and we're now fighting this. But I think this is where, you know, the importance of not fixing, not predetermining everything before you've actually realised and convinced people that it's a good place to be rather than it's a good place for everyone. So I think there's this big thing of showing, there's a couple of the really forward-thinking developments happening in the country at the moment saying, let's build it. Let's show how good a place it is. It's not a punishment to live close to where you work. It's actually for everyone's benefit. So it's a positive way of looking at things rather than punishing people for not living sustainably enough.
Obviously, you've done loads of research here. For listeners, I'm pointing to a document right in front of me. There's hopefully this will be ready and we'll be able to put a link to the Tate Hindle website with this document on. But is there any other points you'd like to talk around within this? You've covered some of them off.
I think, again, we keep going to this European model, but I think there's a lot of lessons learned, and in terms of public spaces as well. I think one of the key things that's happened in the last sort of, you know, 3 years is the life has spilled out onto the streets.
When
I first moved to UK, I was quite surprised to see people not sitting outside in the nice weather, and that, you know, the culture has changed and shifted. So it is possible. I think it's really important to highlight some of really good examples of the culture shift in the last couple of years to say, actually, you know, in Denmark, people were apprehensive about Jan Gehl saying, don't let the roads dominate the centres, let people out. And, oh, well, actually, it's really cold. You know, who is going to be sitting outside in -5? But, you know, this winter, if you went to Soho, the streets have been flooded with people sitting outside. And, you know, around Shoreditch, it's incredible as well how many richer the street life is. And that's been a great culture change for this country. And it's been absolutely amazing to see. And people actually dwelling rather than just moving. I think that's one of the biggest points that we're trying to get across, is designing places for dwelling, not constantly thinking how to get from A to B as fast as possible.
And stop people loitering.
And stop people loitering and, yes, put spikes so people can't...
You can't relax here, sorry, goodbye.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the things that we're, you know, at Tate Hindle, we're really keen in our master planning work to get across. And it's, you know, learning from the communities. It's not that we're trying to invent the wheel here. We're just saying there are really good things that are happening around the world. Why don't we learn from them? And why don't we apply some of them to our culture?
So obviously, big change for you. I mean, it was not long after COVID you moved to Tayhindle. But no. what attracted you to them? And I know you've talked to me briefly about the culture there being phenomenal. So
yes, it's a great place. It's a lovely, lovely group of people, very friendly. And I was attracted as well, I have to say, to the office space is really bright and airy, and
that's lovely, isn't it? Yeah,
very nice. Yes, and lovely.
I haven't
seen
your terrace actually. I didn't know there was
no,
one.
No, but the weather hasn't been great, has it?
Yeah.
We need to. You have to come over, and we can have a glass of wine. And we're looking. We have the three-way views, but we also look at the west, so we get the sunset. It's absolutely
nice.
Brilliant.
And that's right on Shoreditch High Street, right?
Yes,
it's close to the centre.
I think another thing that offices also have to be, and why I also like Tayhindle, is it's not just about the office, it's the environment that the office is in to attract people. So the fact that, you know, we're in Shoreditch, the life is buzzing around us, we can see from the office, we can see the overground, it's full of life. And one of the things that really, before I joined, I really, you know, sitting in the meeting room, seeing the overground, you could just feel the heart of London beating. It was just great. But again, it's all of these ingredients. The office works as a hub. As I said, it's not really, you know, it is open plan, but there are places to, we are now creating some booths for quiet meeting time. What's been really good about it is Tayhindle have moved by luck, not by intention, post-COVID moved offices, and they've gone into this beautiful space in Shoreditch High Street. But they've also decided to inhabit a space for a bit and not prefix everything. So we're still working on some things in the space, but it's been great to live in the space for a year and a half, understand the work patterns and life
requirements
and adapt the space to them. So that's why we're at the moment we're changing some of the sort of the hub area where we call it the town hall, where we have our talks and our staff meetings and our lunches, and we're creating some of the sort of more private booths for those sort of one-on-one phone meetings. But I think that's been one great thing about Tayhindle, that the office is ever-changing. It's been great to see how, with the community, with them being office designers, creating an office for themselves, I think it does really help understanding that side of things, and having this, you know, partitions. And I think we do have the hot desk policy. We had this discussion the other day. How do we allow people? Yes, we are changing desks and we have our little, you know, spaces and cupboards where we put our stuff away. But how do you allow people to make spaces their own in that day that they're inhabiting the desk? Because we have shifted from this, you know, you had your 10 picture frames and your plant pots on your desk, now to having a clear desk policy at the end of the day. And people do realise, actually, I do like a bit of my own stuff on my desk. How do you allow that? We've got a great system of booking desks in advance. And people, it's been, you know, Tayhindle has also been observing how people, there's definitely people with preferences for different seats. So learning from the office design of, you know, people go to the certain places for reasons, and you have to allow for this to happen in a space. You have to have quite different spaces that people can. So we can, at the moment, we can take our laptop and sit in one of the desks, and that desk can be in front of the entrance door or can be next to the window, sort of a bit, as I read it recently, a ninja-proof space. You're back against the wall if you want.
I love that, yeah.
If you like something a bit more, if you're more of an introvert and you want a bit more of a hideaway, we can also take the laptop and sit in the middle of the town hall or the hub, or at the desk. We have a couple of desks floating around, so you can actually choose where you sit, not just from a sea of same desks. Basically, you choose where you sit, but it's all the same. We do have quite different environments, and you can just choose and just sit on a sofa and work as well. We've got some really nice sofas, sort of next to windows and lounge spaces. So I think I really like that.
Yeah, it feels like they work really hard on their culture as well. So there's a lot of little nice things, as you mentioned briefly before, you know, the breakfasts and things like that, little talks and things like that going on. So there's a real sort of socialising events and a lot of activity that goes into making that work.
Definitely. We've got this thing, staff meeting, but it's much more than that. And everyone gets to present, all the projects get sort of three slides just to update everyone. So everyone knows there's a huge amount of transparency within the practice, which is brilliant. Tayhindle is an employee-owned trust. Definitely felt the culture is very different to other ways of working because there is a lot more transparency and communication. So every month we have this thing called staff meeting, and what they're trying to do, and what it felt like a bit like last week when we had one, is it felt a bit like a festival. So basically on Thursday we had a sort of this staff meeting. We have a spread and drinks, and you know, people update everyone on projects. We do sort of, we have something called 5 minutes of fame, where someone comes out and talks about a topic related to our work that they're passionate about. We have, you know, obviously HR updates and other business updates, but we also then during the day, Tehindal is trying to organize lunchtime CPDs or design reviews. Then we had breakfast all together, so they turned it into this bit, and we had board game night after the staff meeting.
Oh, nice.
So it did really feel like a day of festival, and I think that they're really trying to build that positive culture.
Brilliant.
And to get people together. So yes, I've really been enjoying that.
Nice. I think I'm too competitive. I'd probably spoil everyone's day if I bought board games in our office.
Or you took 5 minutes of fame and then board games. Yeah, and like, Dan, it's all about you. It's a staff meeting, not a barn meeting.
That's familiar. This is great stuff. Thank you so much. What little takeaways can we take from today then? What are the three things people need to be considering when they're sort of trying to merge this resi world and office world?
I think, keep banging on about this, loose fit and flexibility to allow people agency and freedom and empowerment in spaces they inhabit, whether it's work or home. I think this thing about rethinking the commute and whether it's worth it to start with, and whether there are places that you can work closer to home without having to make the change. And I think it's always, for us designers, it's always looking at the bigger picture and the detail, not just one or the other. So I'd say that's my three takeaways, if they're okay.
They're great. Thank you so much. Ivana, thank you. That was brilliant.
Oh, such a pleasure. And I can't wait to have drinks with you on our terrace looking at the sunset over West London soon. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Spacecraft Podcast, conversations on how innovative design can transform the workplace environment. This podcast was brought to you by Them, with host Dan Muscrop.